Welcome to the Insurance Refocus podcast, where we're highlighting real agent stories and how they are innovating to respond to the changes and challenges happening in the independent insurance industry. My name's Lindsay, and I can't wait to introduce you to my amazing co-host who just so happens to be my mom, Carrie Wallace. Mom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Lindsay. I am super excited to be podcasting with you. It's one of my favorite days that I get to hang out with you all day long. So we have a treat today. Today we have Miss Jennifer Weaver of Manning, Fulton, and Skinner joining us to talk about a topic that's on the minds of everyone right now. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Hey, Jennifer, I would love if you know, there might be listeners out there that don't know who you are. So can you give a little bit of a background of your experience in the insurance industry, your experience as a lawyer, your experience working with INC and lots of our clients? I would love for you to just give a brief overview of that.
Sure. Our firm has had a relationship with IANC for a while now. We support with litigation work. We support with questions that folks might have about entity formation and other sort of, corporate kinds of questions that come up. My particular area of practice is combined. I do general corporate work, contracts, and setting up companies and helping folks run their businesses. I also work in the area of mergers and acquisitions. So when people are preparing to sell or buy a company, we represent them as they go through that process. And the third area of my practice sort of dovetails into those because it's employment law. And so we really like to think of the fact that we can represent a business owner from cradle to grave, from the beginning of their entity formation through gaining contracts and hiring an employee and beginning to do the work that they do and then preparing for sale or succession planning. And so we've worked with a lot of insurance professionals who are in various stages of that life cycle. We really enjoy working with insurance professionals and their staff as they grow and as they change and as they maybe buy a new company or prepare to sell. And so, you know, it's a sweet spot for us to work with those folks who are contributing very much in their communities. We feel a particular fondness for those folks.
Yeah. And it's actually allowed you and I to work a fair amount with each other, with common clients. You know, I do a fair amount of work in North Carolina, South Carolina, actually all across the country. And you've been instrumental in helping many of my agents put together a perpetuation plan, a buy-sell agreement, representing the sales side, representing the buyer side. Like we've gotten to work a fair amount together, and I always feel super comfortable sending an agent your way because you've just got this incredible vast knowledge, not only from producer agreements or employment agreements, but also that M&A, which is super difficult to find. So I love, love, love. And as soon as I read that the FTC banned non-compete clauses in employment contracts, you were the first person I thought of. I was like, okay, this is going to create a lot of questions, man. This is a lot of people are going to be worried about this, thinking about this, not knowing exactly what it means. So I'd love if you would just do a brief overview of what this ruling actually means and what the FTC actually said.
So non-competes have been an area of hot debate for many years now, with a lot of courts chipping away at the edges of what those are. And remember, a non-compete is an agreement between two parties, an employer and an employee, whereby the employee is prevented during or after employment for a period of time from going to work for a competitor. And that's really the crux of the non-compete area. And so the FTC has looked at this and they've said, how does this affect trade? And so what they said was they voted recently on their final rule They initially proposed this rule back in January of 2023, and they asked for public comment. They got 26,000 public comments of people coming in and saying, this is my perspective, this is how we feel about it. And those public comments came from individuals, and they also came from organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and various secretaries of state and various organizations put in their votes. But what they decided was that they were going to bar employers from entering into or enforcing non-compete clauses with employees, independent contractors, and any other category of paid or unpaid workers, including externs, interns, volunteers, apprentices, or anyone who provides services to them. So what they said was, they said, okay, we're going to ban these non-competes. You can't have a non-compete with someone. If you have an existing non-compete, that's no longer enforceable. We will have a very narrow exception for non-competes with senior executives that are in current agreements. It has to be someone who earns more than $150,000 a year. So those senior executive non-competes, if you've got those in place and they're current, i.e. they're already in place, those will continue to be enforceable, but you can't enter into new ones. So anything that we currently have, you know, in the hopper where we're negotiating those non-competes at this point in time, everybody's like, hands off, we can't do that, even if it is a senior executive. So that's sort of what they said, is that they're banning all of those. Employers are required to give notice and inform all their employees that those non-compete clauses will not be enforced.
So, Jennifer, let me ask you a question. So many producers inside an agency make well over $150,000 a year. So if I'm listening to this podcast, I might ask myself, what constitutes executive? Does it mean they have to be an owner? Does it mean that they have to have a compensation level? Like, what exactly constitutes executive?
It's generally going to be someone who's a decision maker and who's overseeing others. Now, I'm just telling you a general definition that at this point in time has not been fleshed out enough for us to give a, oh, no, hold on. Here it is. Yep, it did. It's got to be someone who is in a policy-making position, and they received at least $151,164 in the preceding year. It's got to be those two things. And so there's a lot of information about what that compensation looks like, you know, whether it's salary, commissions, all those kinds of things. All those are included in that definition of total annual compensation.
What does that mean, someone who makes policy decisions? Does that just mean that they are a decision maker or that they oversee people? What would be your interpretation of making policy, like in an agency?
Yeah, so if they have the authority to say, we're going to change our insurance from one to another company, you know, our health insurance that we're getting for our employees. Or if they have the ability to say, you know what, we're going to move from a PTO of, you know, 4 weeks a year to, you know, we're going to do daily. Or any kind of changes that are going to affect sort of how the company is run, those are going to be policymakers. So if you have a producer who's working and doing, you know, and has their own clients and, you know, is contributing to the agency, but they're not making decisions about how the agency is run, that's not going to be that level of executive that we're looking at.
Question actually for you, Mom. Do you think are in agencies, are producers allowed to have their own relationships with like carriers? Like, how does that work in an agency? Would that, like, if someone was able to go out and get a new carrier contract, would that make them
Yeah, I hear what you're asking.
I'm forgetting the term that we use.
Would that make them a policy decision maker? Typically, the carriers that appoint people are appointing the owner of the agency. So those things typically go hand in hand. I've never seen an agency where a producer has an appointment, but the overall agency does not, and it's not an owner. We also typically see carriers will be choosy as ownership of the agency is changing, whether or not they'll continue to appoint that agency or that person based on their confidence of the new owner. So it typically, if it's appointed to a person, it is the owner or someone who's the decision maker in the agency. So I think that wouldn't change it. So Jennifer, a lot of questions about this. I mean, my phone rang a lot when this first came out and said, okay, what does this actually mean? Because the reality is having these agreements in tech of business, your key people, and the ongoing retention income typically makes up between 87 and 95% of an agency's ongoing revenue. In a hard market, it's closer to the 95, 97%. Off market, it could be closer to that 87%, but it is what drives ongoing expectation of revenue and the predictability that drives value inside an agency. So if I'm an agency owner, I'm worried about what does this change mean, and could potentially my producer walk away with their book of business because of this particular change? And it's kind of a loaded question because I know there's many different ways to protect your book of business. And this, I don't think, is one of them, but you talk to me about what protects your book of business.
So that's a great question. And I think that there's a lot of confusion because people rely or think that they should rely so heavily on a non-compete. There are other ways that we feel are stronger to protect a company's business. The first thing is to make sure that you have really good confidentiality and non-disclosure agreements with your employees. Those can be really helpful when you're saying to an employee, you can't take information from our company to another company. That is our confidential information. However, confidential information doesn't include contact information for folks. So when you have, you know, if there's information that you can find out on the internet, then it can't be confidential information. So then you have to turn to what we call non-solicitation agreements. And those have to, and sometimes in the insurance industry, we call those non-piracy agreements. And there's two different aspects of those. The first aspect is to say you as an employee cannot take with you when you leave clients of ours. Now, that clients of ours piece is really important because if a producer comes in and they say, this is my book of business, it belongs to me, then that doesn't belong to the company and the company can't exert any kind of authority over that book of business. So our insurance friends have to start looking at what their agreements are with their producers and say, what exactly do I own here? And what do they own? And what's the deal that I've made with them? Because sometimes folks are willing to overlook that by saying, oh, well, it's fine if you come in and bring your book of business because you can't go in and compete with me. Well, now they can, and they can take that book of business with them. So it's really important to look back at all of your agreements that you have with folks and say, wait a minute, I need to understand my arrangement with each of these people, each of my producers, to make sure that I haven't relied too much on a non-compete that's no longer going to give me the protection that I thought I once had. So there's that aspect of it, that non-solicitation. The other part of a non-solicitation is non-soliciting employees of the company. So they're not going to take their whole book of business along with the support staff that services all of those clients. So you don't want both of those things to leave at the same time. You want those non-solicitation agreements to be you know, tight and enforceable. And one of the things that you're going to have to watch out for when we're enforcing a non-solicitation of any sort, right, is to make sure that there's adequate consideration when you entered into that. Each party got something for giving something up, and that it's reasonable as to time and territory. So a non-solicitation for 10 years, likely not going to be enforceable. A non-solicitation for a year or two is more enforceable, right? And we have to always go back to what is the business interest we're trying to protect. Whatever these covenants, we call them covenants, restrictive covenants is the sort of umbrella term that we use. Whatever that covenant is, it has to be narrowly tailored to protect a legitimate business interest. And each of those words is really important because we want to narrowly define it and make sure that whatever our business interest is that we're concerned about is a legitimate one, like a real concern, and that we are tailoring our covenant as narrowly as possible to protect that particular interest. I had a client once who sold their company, and part of the work that they did was work out in the field. They had crews of guys out in the field, right, doing various work jobs. And they sold their company, and when the buyers came in, they delivered to all of those employees a document that was a 2-year non-compete. Even to these rank and file, I go out, I'm a crew guy, I'm holding a flag on a road, you know, a 2-year non-compete. Clearly that was not going to be enforceable, right? There was no legitimate business interest that they were worried about. They were doing a blanket non-compete. 2 years is way more than is enforceable for one of those rank and file kind of guys, but it scared those guys. And if they get a cease and desist letter from their former employer because they're out working for the only other company where they can get a flag switching job, then they're like, what am I going to do? Move my family, you know, 50 miles away. So we really want to make sure when we're doing these non-solicits that they are also narrowly tailored to protect that legitimate business interest.
So let me just... You said a couple things in there that I want to clarify. So first and foremost, what if there's an agreement? There's a producer agreement, an employee agreement that includes language that is a non-compete, a non-piracy, and a non-solicit, all in the same agreement. Mm-hmm. If I'm an agency owner, you just said it's my responsibility to communicate to my staff that the non-compete is no longer valid unless it's a policymaker making over $150,000 or $151,000 a year. Mm-hmm. What do I do with that agreement? Do I have to rewrite the agreement today? That's the first part of my question. And the second part is you said consideration. I definitely want to spend some time on the consideration because if I'm rewriting my agreement, what is adequate consideration for that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think one thing to note is that the language that the FTC is requiring is simply a statement from employers that they will not be enforcing those non-competes.
Okay.
So it is not a statement saying that you have to completely revise or chunk and redo all of your employment agreements. They're not going to make us do that. But there has to be a statement from the employer saying, we are not going to enforce that particular provision. So that's the first piece of this is to say, okay, and we don't, well, we'll come back to that. But so that would be something that an employer would need to do is to make this statement. And it's probably going to be a written statement that you have to make. There's going to be specific language. It may have to be posted, all those kinds of things. So we've got that piece of it. If you look at your agreements and you realize, oh no, I've relied too much on the non-compete. My non-solicit is not strong enough. It needs to be stronger. I've got to do something. I need to change these agreements. I need to change this relationship with some of my producers, right? Then you're going to have a conversation and say, okay, we're changing this. Part of the reason that we did non-competes was to protect this company for which you currently work. I know that you want to continue to protect this company, and therefore we're going to make some changes in our agreements. And one of the changes that we're going to do is we're going to change our non-solicitation. Well, if someone is already working for you, okay, continued employment is not sufficient, what we call consideration, for a new agreement. Consideration is, in order to give something up, you've got to get something in return. So you are asking, if you're asking someone to give up their right to solicit clients, okay, they're giving up that right. If you are asking them to give up that right and you're saying, well, we want you to give this up, but we're not going to give you anything in exchange. We just want you to agree that allowing you to stay employed here is a sufficient benefit to you that you would sign this. Courts have said continued employment is not sufficient. You got to give them something else. You can give them a bonus. You can raise their compensation. You can give them an extra couple of days of PTO. Any of those things are fine. People say, what is sufficient consideration for that, right? What is enough? And, you know, the courts have been remarkably unhelpful in giving us guidelines as to what might be good consideration, right? So it's what's going to be meaningful to your employees. It might be, for some employee, it may be a $100 bonus might be sufficient. For another employee, it might need to be something more than that. And so that's really a facts and circumstances test. And I hate to give you that answer because it's really not helpful, but it is something that you have to evaluate each individual kind of circumstance to say, what is meaningful to my employee in this situation? You know, for some employees, an extra day of PTO is going to make a big deal for most of these folks, and sure, they're going to be happy to sign it. They're like, yeah, I agreed to it before. You're going to give me an extra day off. I'm good with that. For some folks, it might take a little bit more. The general language in the old case law is a peppercorn of consideration. I don't know many people who would agree to a non-solicit for a peppercorn, but I guess it depends on how good the pepper is.
But how old is that? That's funny. That's super funny.
It's pretty ancient. Yeah. It's pretty ancient. So when we think about this, okay, so we want folks to start looking at their agreements. Now, we all know, right, litigation is going to play out over this already. The United States Chamber of Commerce is already sued. Like, they've already filed their case. So there's entirely the chance that there's going to be a nationwide injunction against this whole ban, right? Okay. So there might be that. But courts are watching this, and they're listening to what the arguments are that the FTC is making, right? And the FTC is saying, you know, 20% of U.S. workers are currently bound by some sort of non-compete agreement. That's a lot of workers, right? And they're saying, you know, their arguments are that non-compete agreements suppress wages, they harm competition by blocking employees from moving around, you know, and their goal is to create a competitive, thriving economy. That's what the FTC does, right? And so they're looking at trade and they're trying to figure out how to continue to increase that sort of talent pool and to create sort of healthy competition, right? So that's their argument. Now, whether that argument is going to play out on this particular ban, I don't know. But courts are certainly watching, right, to see what the FTC has done and what the arguments are and what the argument's going to be from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, about the right to protect trade secrets and sensitive information from rival companies who want to poach your talent. You know, I mean, as lawyers, we experience this. We can't really do non-competes, but We experience this because we get a young lawyer in who's new out of law school, right? You haven't even taken the plastic off of them yet. They're brand new. And they come in and you teach them everything that you know, and you spend these hours educating them. And then they say, oh, I'm really marketable now. I'm going to go to another law firm where I can jump up faster into a different sort of, you know, a different stage in my practice. And so we understand how that feels when you train someone and work for someone and introduce them to all of your clients and given them your best trade secrets and your tips, and then to have them say, you know what, thanks, I really appreciate this. I'm going to go take this knowledge and information and skills that I've developed and go somewhere else. And so
it's a big challenge.
It's a huge challenge.
I hear it all the time, like in agents, you know, I'm not sure I want to support my agent getting a designation because I'm training them for the next person. It's a terrible way to think, but it is a reality in a small business. You put a lot of time, energy, and effort into building your staff. You want them to stay. You know, the other side to that is create an environment that they want to stay in. Create, you know, meet them and the needs that they have, not just monetarily, but the culture they want to work in, you know, pathway to ownership, which gets us to the other things that we work with together. But, you know, the thing that I heard from this is, number one, this doesn't change the risk inside an agency to hold its value if you had non-solicits in place or a non-piracy clause that is strong. So number one, read the contracts you have. Mm-hmm. Number two, you have to take action and actually notify that those solicitations will not be enforced. It would also be a great time to reinforce what will be enforced in those agreements and what they've already agreed to. And if they haven't agreed to something, it's an opportunity to reach out and actually strengthen what you have inside those agreements. And that consideration thing, I think you need to get help and figure out what that consideration is. I was leaning a lot of this on what do we do for a producer? But the reality is, inside an agency, account managers are incredibly valuable as well. They hold a lot of the relationships. They do a lot of the support and service, and especially in a hard market, they're the ones talking to your clients. So these have to be in agreements for all the people inside your agency that touch your clients, in my opinion. But the consideration might look different. Mm-hmm. The length of time might look different. You need to actually do the analysis and see what makes sense for your business and your roles, or your agency and your roles. The thing that we kind of like brushed over is the FTC banned non-competes, but it also changed the threshold, the salary threshold, and overtime exemptions for exempt and non-exempt employees. I get asked all the time, what the heck is exempt? Who is an exempt employee? Who's a non-exempt employee? Can we talk about that just for a little bit? Because I think if you're going to do this review, you should do the whole review, not just look at the non-competes. Like you gotta actually think about the whole shebang here, right?
That's right. I mean, you need to sit down and look at each of your employees and make sure that their classification as exempt versus non-exempt is correct. People a lot of times think that exempt and non-exempt, and what I'm talking about here is the Wage and Hour Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act. And what we're talking about is people who are exempt from overtime and people who are not exempt from overtime. And it's a confusing phraseology, like it's awkward, because if you're non-exempt, you're entitled to overtime. If you're exempt, you don't get overtime. And so a lot of times people conflate exempt and non-exempt with salaried and hourly. And they think, mm-hmm. oh, if they're salaried, then they're not entitled to overtime. That's not true. If you're salaried, you start out with the presumption that you are entitled to overtime. If you work more than 40 hours a week, you would get paid time and a half for the work that you did in addition to that. Okay. You have to fit into one of the exemptions in order to be exempt from overtime. Okay. So what they're talking about right now is increasing the salary threshold for overtime exemptions. What we say is there are a couple of different categories of employees who can be, as salaried people, exempt from overtime. And those categories are folks who are administrative professionals, sort of your white collar workers, your office workers, a learned professional like an accountant, an attorney, a nurse, an engineer, people who have to get an advanced degree, a creative professional, some computer related folks, highly compensated employees. So my guess is what we're going to be looking at, the category of folks that you're going to be looking at an insurance agency, are your support staff there. Okay. They're the administrative professionals. Okay. And those administrative professionals, in order for them to be exempt professionals, they have to have their primary duty being the performance of sort of office non-manual work directly related to the management and general business operations. And they have to be able to exercise discretion and independent judgment. So let's picture you have Bob, and Bob is your bookkeeper in the office. Okay. And right now, sure. Bob does all of the office work. He does all the bookkeeping. He exercises discretion. He makes independent judgments. He is working for you, right? Right now, let's say you're paying Bob $40,000 a year. Okay. That's what Bob gets. Right now, Bob would be exempt from overtime. Okay. His salary threshold is high enough and his duties match with an exemption. According to the Department of Labor, effective July 1st of this year, that overtime exemption salary is going to go up to $43,888. So unless you increase his compensation, he's now entitled to overtime.
Oh, so it's an and. So it has to be the role, the discretionary decision-making and compensation will determine
right.
that.
Ah, gotcha. It's a two-factor okay. test. It's got to be a salary test and a duties test. So it's got to okay. be both things. So they're keeping the duties the same. All the duties are the same. But if you had a group of employees who you all, you know, who were below, who were above the current salary threshold, that threshold is now bumping up to $43,888. January 1, 2025, so this is a two-part jump, it will go up to $58,656. That's a 65% jump from where it currently is today.
Ooh. Oh my, okay. That is not friendly to some small business owners, unfortunately.
It is not. It is going to be tough for some of our small business owners. And so they have to decide, okay, am I going to bump this person up so they continue to be exempt? Or am I going to change their classification to non-exempt, whereby they would be entitled to overtime, but they're never going to work more than 40 hours, so I don't have to pay them overtime. Or they only work more than 40 hours during tax time, and I'm willing to go ahead and pay them the extra $1,000 or $2,000 that would be necessary to give them overtime during that time of year, but I'm not willing to bump them up to the full $58,656 that I would need to.
So let me ask you, I'm thinking about the roles inside an agency, okay, mm-hmm. for non-piracy, non-solicit, and this exemption situation. So we know producers are going to have discretion. They're going to have the ability to make more money. So that one I'm not worried about, right? Mm-hmm. That one is focus on your non-piracy, focus on your non-solicit. Know that the non-compete is no longer valid unless it's an owner of the agency that's making decisions. We already know that. Mm-hmm. Next, I would go to account manager. That person has to be licensed. Does that check the exemption for them? They have to have an insurance license, and they're most likely going to be held to that test for the compensation, correct?
So I would think that that might fit in with a learned professional, because those are people who have to get licenses or certifications or something like that. They still have that same threshold. So if you have,
we still have to worry about that dollar amount. Yeah.
Still have to worry about the dollar amount. Unless, I mean, we do have some folks who we call highly compensated employees. There is an exemption for them. And that threshold is going up. So they could be doing anything. They could be emptying the trash. But if you pay them more than $132,000 a year, then they're exempt under the highly compensated employees exemption, and you don't have to pay them overtime for their trash collection. So okay. There is a highly compensated employees sort of exception for this, but I don't expect most folks to run into that because I think most folks who are getting paid at that high level are going to fit into a different exemption anyway.
That's right. So that would apply, you know, if you're licensed agents, your licensed CSRs, your licensed account managers, and all of them, it really is that dollar threshold you have to pay attention to. And the recourse for this is if you have not accurately classified them and you are not paying them overtime, you could potentially be subject to an audit and have to pay that back. Is that correct?
That's right. It's penalties associated with and back overtime. So you're looking at all hours of overtime that they should have been paid overtime for and they haven't been, plus the penalties that are associated with that. And so what and this may be challenged in court too, although we think this is less likely to be challenged because of the path that it's taken through and who's doing the rulemaking. This is the FTC versus the Department of Labor. So we've got two different groups who issued rulings on the same day. But we think that at this point in time, employers need to start planning on how they're going to comply with this. We want them to proceed with caution on an actual rollout, like let's just take our time thinking about this, look everything over, make sure you're not rushing to do something. But you need to start looking at your employees whose salaries fall between the current salary threshold, which is $35,568. So anyone who earns that amount, okay, and between that and the new threshold of $43,888. So in that delta right there, you need to start looking for those folks and decide whether you're going to increase their salaries to keep them exempt or whether you're going to convert them to a non-exempt employee.
There's a lot to think about with this. There's a lot, right? I mean, we could probably talk about this all day long. I mean, because I have even more questions about the way in which agencies decide to employ people with being a W-2 employee, being a 1099, it all boils down to you have to have agreements in place that are clear to say who owns what, and that's the best way to protect your business and protect the value of your business. You also need to make sure that you're compensating appropriately and classifying your staff appropriately, or you might have a liability that you did not know you had. Jennifer, there's no way we could cover all of this, but I think you gave us a super, super strong overview and some key things that agents that are listening to this, if you own an agency, you have employees, you've got to pay attention to this in order to protect your agency. If you were going to give them 3 to 5 things they should do right now and how to proceed with caution, why don't you share what that is?
I think the first thing that I would suggest is that you take a look at all of your employment arrangements. So that means going through and looking at your employment agreements. Let's start with those, right? If you have employment agreements, take a look at those. Let's see whether there's a non-compete in there that you may have to deal with in the future. Then you're going to look at how am I going to protect what I've created here. So make sure you've got confidentiality agreements, non-solicitation agreements in those folders. Make sure that your employees are under those restrictions. And then you're going to take a look at how you've classified your employees as exempt or non-exempt, and really take a critical eye in looking at those, because a lot of times folks have classified employees as exempt when they should not be. And if you go back to your employees now and you say, oh, well, I should have been paying you overtime, but I haven't, that can be an awkward conversation. So you can use this new legislation as a little bit of cover on when you are, you know, sort of trying to figure out whether somebody is exempt or non-exempt. And then the last thing I think I would do is take a real critical eye at who you have qualified as an employee and who you have classified as an independent contractor. That would be a 1099 worker. And so you need to be sure that when you are paying someone by 1099, that they really are an independent contractor and not an employee. And that is that's a tough test. And you need to do some analysis about where your folks fall.
Well, maybe we'll have you back just to talk about that topic and that topic alone, because there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot of agents that their strategy is to employ 1099 producers or 1099 roles within their agency. And I just want to be able to provide as much information and have people make informed decisions about the structure they're creating. No question about it. If an agent listened to this and thinks, oh my goodness, I need help, how can they get in touch with you, Jennifer? I know you work all the time in this area. So give them how to reach out to you and what that looks like.
Yeah, I'm reachable via our website. That's manningfulton.com. You can reach me directly via email at weaver@manningfulton.com. Or if you want to reach out to Carrie, she can give you my contact information. Or you can just search for me on the web. I think it's pretty easy to find me. We are in Raleigh and in Durham, but we do help folks in many other areas. So feel free to reach out. We'd love to just give you some additional perspective, comfort, or guidance, depending on what you need.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today and providing some clear direction on what could be super overwhelming and confusing. We really appreciate you joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Insurance Refocus podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please be sure to hit subscribe and leave us a review so you'll never miss us. Want to learn more about how Agency Focus can help you grow your agency? Head to agency-focus.com or email Carrie directly at carrie@agency-focus.com. If you need to get in touch with me, feel free to shoot me an email at lindsay@agency-focus.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week.